Welcome to Crossroads, a podcast that explores the intersection of faith and Christian living. Crossroads is part of the media ministry at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. Get to know us by visiting us online at fapc.org.
Hi, folks. Welcome to Crossroads in the Living Room. I'm Jamie Staley, Director of Christian Education here at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church. This year, we have our Credo series, our annual adult education, where our pastors talk about the theological foundations of our faith. And this year, our series theme is Mothers of the Messiah. We are looking at the lineage of Jesus found in the book of Matthew, where there are four women named as ancestors of Jesus. I am thrilled to be here with Reverend Dr. Jonah So to talk about our first ancestor, Tamar, found in the book of Genesis. So welcome, Jonah. So excited to have this conversation with you.
Thanks, Jamie, for having me. This is such a great opportunity to have a conversation, to dive deeper into a fascinating life, and to put that all together into that bigger story that you just teed up for us.
Awesome. So let's dive right in with the story of Tamar. Folks at home, if you have your Bibles, the story is found in Genesis 38. I would encourage you to read it before you watch this or after, you know, to be able to dive deeper with Jonah. So the story of Tamar is found in the midst of the story of Joseph, really. You know, he's doing his, as a child, and then he's getting kidnapped and taken off to Egypt. And right in the middle of that, we find this story of Tamar in Genesis 38. And Tamar is the daughter-in-law of Judah, who we've seen earlier in some other stories, right? And so she gets married to Judah's son, and unfortunately he dies. And so Judah marries her to his second son. And Tamar is unable to have children with either of these two men. And so what she does is she disguises herself as a temple prostitute and goes and ends up being with Judah, sort of tricks him, does some things to trick him, and ends up pregnant. And those children that she has with Judah are listed in the lineage of Jesus as well as her in the book of Matthew.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was a really brief overview.
Oh, no,
so
that's folks, a great overview. And that's the thing, like I just to put in there, kidnapping is a cool way to put it. He was sold, but like very much like it's almost like that, you know? But and I guess because these stories are, I always see them in cartoony versions from the children's Bible. These are horrific stories, but they're cartoony. And so like it's like, wow. And so that's part of my fascination about exploring the Bible. Holy scripture that we love, we learn in Sunday school, can be so dark and terrible. And this is a horrible story. It's about 12 brothers. 11 of them are so jealous of Joseph that they plot to kill him. Long story short, Judah, the one of the protagonists of this story, comes up with the idea, oh, let's not kill our brother, let's sell him. They're the band of traders. So he engages the slave trade, sells his brother for 20 pieces of silver. And that is where, after Joseph is sold in chapter 37, we enter into chapter 38, which is sort of a break between the Joseph's narrative and his story. And part of the question is, why this story? Totally, arguably out of place. What does this have to do with the, Joseph's story? And so that's kind of where we enter Genesis chapter 38. And you're right. Judah is one of Joseph's 12 sons, and he himself has three sons. Er is the first son. Onan is the second son. And Shelah is his third son. And so Er did what was evil and wicked in the sight of the Lord, so God smites him. And then Judah tells Onan, hey, you have to do the duty of the next brother, and you need to you know, marry Tamar and give a child so that your brother's name can carry on. But he doesn't like that. And we'll go over it. I'll say more about that. But he doesn't like that. And so he ends up not doing his duty. And then he ends up being smitten. And now Judah's down to one son and he's so worried. At this point, Shelah's a little young. So he ultimately tells Tamar, hey, go to your father-in-law's house. Let my son grow up before I give him to you. And Tamar waits and waits and waits. And so that sets up a scenario where Judah's wife eventually dies. And this is fascinating to me because you ask, why are these four women named in the Bible? And Judah's wife doesn't even have a name. She remains unnamed the whole time. They just kept saying the wife of Judah. And so the wife of Judah passes and he's grieving. And once he's done grieving, he goes on a trip with his friend. And on the way, he's going to stop by a temple. And I'll get to that in a moment about how, you know, interesting temples can be. And Tamar hears this and devises a plot where, you're right, she tricks Judah into having relations. And then she gets pregnant by him. And it sets up for a very dramatic scene where the rest of the family is like, oh my gosh, Tamar played the harlot. And she's pregnant. What are we going to do? And Judah says, bring her out that she might be burned. Condemns her like that. And Tamar, before she goes out to meet her doom, sends a message quietly to Judah. And in the message, Judah realizes, oh my gosh, that's me. I did that. And Judah fesses up and says, I've been bad. And he says, she's more right than I. And again, we'll get into that, but that's the story. And ultimately Judah is like, okay, I was wrong. She was right. And then we move on to Joseph. So it's like, what is this piece of chapter 38 doing between Joseph being sold to slavery and then, you know, to Potiphar's house, the chief, security guard of the Pharaoh? And then in 38, we start meeting Potiphar's wife, who takes a liking for Joseph. And that takes its own dramatic and story. But where does this fit? So that's kind of where how we could kind of paint that picture of chapter 38.
Perfect. Thanks for filling in those gaps. You hinted at this a few times already, but, you know, it's very important when we are reading the Bible to understand the culture in which these stories are set and to understand the rules by which all of these characters are playing. So can you tell us a little bit about what do we need to know culturally to understand this, what's happening here?
Absolutely. One of the things that I love Bible study for is because of the fact that when you read the Bible, you're bringing yourself and your experiences, and naturally you put yourself into the story, whether you're a narrator observing or whether you're an actual character, you put yourself in there and it's you with all of your culture, all of your ways, and you listen. And when you do that, the Bible can really, really irk us. And that's okay, because that should then be a sign to say, what's going on here? And so whenever we read scripture, because the scripture was written in a specific time, specific place, and a specific culture, we need to understand that to fully understand what's going on with the characters. And so there's no end to stuff like this, but I would say there are three big things that we would want to know. First is what we call the Levirate Law. Levirate Law is based on the Latin word levir, which means brother's husband. And so what happens when brothers have a wife who die? Why is this important? Well, this is important because in that culture, the patrilineal culture, the oldest son is the name-carrying son, and they're the ones who proliferate the line. Lineages and genealogies are based off of primarily the first son. And so when the firstborn son, to show how important he is, in inheritance law, the firstborn son gets double portion. Most of the time, it's related with the fact that he needs to kind of make sure that the family stays together. But nonetheless, the firstborn son is very important. And so when the first, when there are, let's say, three brothers, like Er, Onan, and Shelah, Er ends up not having a son, then the duty in the Levirate law falls to Onan as the next son to give the wife of Er, his older brother, a child. And even though he is biologically the father, according to the Levirate law, that offspring, if it's a boy, will be the child of the deceased's brother. It's weird, but if you let that sink in for a second, that's how they ensure that the name of the family won't be blotted out. And so they protect that name. And so that sense of Levirate law is important for us to know, why are the brother taking on that wife? These are not love romantic stories that we might find in TV series that draw us in or something. But this is straight up law that needs to make sure family lines can continue. And so that Levirate law is important. If anyone at home wants to look into it more, Levirate law kind of goes away if you have daughters, because daughters were actually allowed to inherit as well. But, you know, we won't go too much into that. So Levirate law is one thing that we need to know. And the second thing is we need to know about prostitution. Now, prostitution, they say, is the oldest vocation. It's around, but it's very important for us to know that in the biblical times, temples had prostitutes. And it's like, what? What does that mean? So just to give an understanding of what's going on in the temple was a place, let's say, that worshipped the god of fertility. Whether it's people who wanted children, or if it's fertility of the ground so that they have great crops. One of the beliefs that they had was this god or goddess, followers believed that they could call on the power of that god by engaging in magic. And part of that magic would be like, oh, the act of sexual intercourse would be paralleling the fertility of the ground. And so in engaging in sexual activity with the prostitute, that magic, that happening, would then be superimposed onto the land by that god or goddess to give more fruit. And so this is how they believed. And so that was an ordinary thing to go and do that. Again, if we look at it in our day and age, that's a little odd, but we have that. And so that is something where Tamar knew that her father-in-law, after grieving the loss of his wife, went to town. And on the way, she dressed in a very attractive manner to catch his eye. And he assumed she was a prostitute. So he propositioned her to say, hey, how can I, you know, what do we need to do here? And so that is the second thing that we need to know. And the third thing that we need to also understand is, in the biblical time, in this time, women did not have the same rights as we have today. And it's horrible, actually. They didn't have any rights. Their rights were related with the man of their life, whether it's their father, their husband, or their son. These three basic categories are the way that women had any standing. If she's unmarried, her father's name is how she, you know, traverses society. When she gets married, it's her husband's name through which she traverses society. And when the husband passes, it's her son that she goes the rest of the way. And so when she has no husband, she's married off, she leaves her father's house, and her husband dies, and there's no son, this woman has nothing to stand on. And so she's cut off, and she's left to the utter mercy and pity of whatever family will care for her. So there's no security in that. And so Tamar is out to make sure her husband Er's line goes forward. And she's out to make sure that she is permitted to get what's due her. But this story is about the justice system and the circumstances that prevent her from being able to do this by taking away her voice and power. She has no recourse. And that's what makes this story fascinating.
Yeah. So you've obviously done so much research into this story. I mean, I feel like I had heard Tamar's name, and, you know, I've read through the Bible, so I've read it. Although it wasn't until recently that I noticed that it was in the midst of this Joseph story, which is an interesting tidbit of why is it right in the middle. But What was your first, you know, was this a relatively new story to you? And if so, what was your first impression, or had you read it before? And what did you think of it as a whole when you first heard it?
That's a great question. I think my first encounter with the story had to be when I was a college student. Just was reading through the Bible, and I came across the story, and I was like, huh. My first reaction was, ew, what? And then I was like, what? That's so weird. How did Judah not know? How did Judah not know it's Tamar, his daughter-in-law? Like, how did he not know? And that's all I heard. How did he not know? How did he not? Whatever. And I kept reading. And that was my experience with it. Back in college, as a young man, it didn't even cross my mind to think, what was Tamar going through? I was just like, how did Judah not know? Because that's who I would be in this story. Like, what? And then I moved on. I am now, you know, married to my wife, Jennifer, who's so smart. And I just am so thankful for her. And I hear her stories and her experiences in the work world. And I feel sad because I love her and she's my wife. And I'm like, oh, really? You go through that? And I'm a father to a teenager. And ever since she was born, I was like, why is it hard for her? This is not right. And with the new lens that I have, just me personally, compared to my college self, this story, re-encountering it, was like, oh my gosh, this is such an important story. Well, first, just to kind of go back and say, like, big picture-wise of, like, chapter 37 of Genesis and then chapter 39 of Genesis, and here we have 38. The story of Joseph is beautiful because it's like Israel is redeemed out of Egypt, set free, and then they lose their status. Then they are now, you know, free people, and then Egypt is the place that has all the food. And with all of the, I'm sitting here trying to like do this real thing really fast, but long story short, Joseph as an Israelite becomes number two most powerful person pretty much in the world, and he saves his people. That's what's going on. It's like, wow, that's our ancestor, our patriarch. Chapter 38 is like a parallel of, it runs alongside to show this patriarch Joseph and his dysfunctional family. And I think that's an important thing, because a lot of times we think that everything is so glorious and glamorized in the Bible. Like, oh, this is only perfect people get to do this stuff. But it's not. Joseph's family had a lot of issues, just like our families. And reading that and saying, oh my gosh, you know, like I say, like I would never want my family's diary to be exposed to everyone to read. And there is Joseph's. And so to see how struggle and non-perfect stuff happens in the life of the patriarch is great. And also is to connect Judah's line in this patriarch story to the way that the lineage that leads to David. Because Joseph's line is not the way that we get to David. It's Joseph's bigger family and Judah that gets us to David and then ultimately to Christ. And so that's what's you know, going on in the bigger picture.
It's so interesting to, you know, that your perspective on this story is different than when you were younger. It makes so much sense, you know, a daughter and a wife to bring you into this broader perspective. So now that you've looked at Tamar through this different lens, she really takes some bold actions. What do you think about her story and her actions and how that plays into kind of the larger story?
Tamar's actions are just, they're bold because they're so risky. And they're risky because the system is set up against her. The system is set up against her because Tamar, as a widowed, childless woman, her family, her Judah's house is supposed to care for her. And in caring for her, Judah's supposed to get, and he did at first, when Er died, Onan is supposed to be, she's supposed to be into Onan. And then Onan dies. because Onan didn't like the Levirate law. He didn't want to make a baby for his older brother because that actually messes up his own family. And we don't know if he had or didn't have children. But nonetheless, this Levirate law says that if he has a child, then that child becomes heirs. Then heirs' family gets the inheritance that he should get. So this is economically, for whatever other reasons, he's not incentivized to do this other than duty. And so he, on the ground that he didn't do his duty, God was displeased, and then Onan is smitten. Shelah should have been given to him. If Judah was following the line of what should have happened to take care of his family, Shelah should have been given to him. But Judah was afraid for his son. Because think about it. He lost two sons. Tamar's the common tie. Maybe it's her. Oh my gosh. I don't want my last son to die. So he protects his younger son. But at whose cost? Tamar's. And I guess, like, if I stand in Judah's shoes, I'm like, this is my kid. I'm going to choose him over Tamar. Makes sense. But Judah is, that's his daughter. He chooses this one over that one, and he chooses to support the one whose society supports them by mere gender, and leaves Tamar, the woman, the widowed childless woman, with nothing. As a matter of fact, he sends her back to her father-in-law's house, meaning, you are now my household. But let me get you out of sight and out of mind. Go back to your father's house. And maybe for us, we think, oh, she's being sent back to her family. But in the mind of the biblical times, the ancient peoples, Tamar is no longer part of her father's household. She was sent away. And her return as a married woman, even though she's widowed, she's still married. She's not free to remarry someone in her hometown. So she has no place in her father's house because she's a stranger, as she's now part of Judah's house. And Judah's like, go. So he's out of sight, out of mind. She has no powers, no recourse. She can't go to the courts and say, I'm going to sue you for not following the law. She has zero recourse. And so when Shelah is of age and then Tamar not given to him, when Judah goes on the trip, she has to make some decisions. And what she does, and this is why Tamar's amazing, it proves that she's so smart and strategic and tactical, because she realizes this is a grieving man, lost his wife. He's going to go past the temple, and she knows nature and people. It's like, I think he's going to probably look to proposition someone there. And so she says, I need to get pregnant. And if he's not giving me his child, I need to do it with someone in his family. And Judah will be the person through which I'll scheme to do this. So again, everyone's like, oh, well, how could she do that? But I emphasize, what recourse does she have in terms of the law and society? So she takes what she has, the only thing she has, and then she strategically places it there. She puts herself there, and then the plan happens as she expects. She is propositioned. And then Judah is like, okay, how about, and then they negotiate, and he says, how about I'll give you a young goat? And she's like, okay, but what are you going to prove? What are you going to give me? You don't have it on you. And he's like, what do you want? And she says, I want your signet, which is that thing that, you know, when you have wax drip, like in the old movies, and then you stamp it, that's your signature. She's like, I want that signet and the cord that it's on, and I want your personalized staff. I'll hold it until you give me the kid back, or the young goat. And he goes, fine, deal. So she takes it. And when she takes that and they have relations, she conceives. The day after, week after, Judah sends his friend back to be like, hey, let's make good. I want you to get my personal effects back, please. Take this young goat, bring back my stuff. And when the friend goes and says, hey, where's the temple prostitute, to the neighbors, they're like, what temple prostitute? And he's like, what? And so he comes back and tells Judah, hey, I tried to look for her, but they said that it's not around. And Judah's like, okay, I don't know. Let's not press this. Let's just hope that she kind of disappeared, and let's keep it quiet. So that's what they do. 3 months later, you can't hide pregnancy. They find Tamar's pregnant, and they're like, the only conclusion they have is like, oh my gosh, you're a harlot. You disgraced our family. As a matter of fact, in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, there are laws that say that if you commit adultery, both the woman who's still married. And I mean, she's not allowed to remarry, and she's not married, and she's pregnant, and the male must be put to death. That's the law. And so when they find that Tamar's pregnant, they're like, Judah, she played the harlot, and she's pregnant. Judah goes, bring her out that she might be burned. And, you know, initially we're probably like, oh, that's crazy. We know the story. What is that what you're going to do so easily when you're the dad? Oh my gosh. We know this as the omniscient, narrators. And we're like, oh my gosh. But the laws say that that's what's supposed to happen. And this is why I love Tamar. Because she has a chance for revenge. And I know as a pastor, I always preach, you know, let vengeance is God's. Let's not lean into that. But just I admit on the human side, just those opportunities of revenge / justice is just so delicious. And she had a chance to blow up Judah's spot by saying, hey, you are the father. But what she does instead is she shows reservation. She quietly sends him a message, sends back the signet, the cord, and the staff and says, hey, father-in-law, the one who owns this is the dad. And as soon as Judah sees it, he's like, oh my gosh, she's more right than I. I was supposed to give Shelah to Tamar, but I didn't. And she did. She acted righteously because what I did. And so not only does she show reservation and kind of honoring and just being a kind person when she didn't have to, the speech that Judah says in verse 26, where she says, she is more righteous than I, is an admission that he acted in such a way that forced Tamar to do what she did. So it absolves her because it was Judah who acted unrightly. And so Tamar doing all this stuff at first is like, oh, what is she doing? But she's acting in a place of desperation, of being resourceful, brave and courageous, and taking action in a system that's built against her. And that is something that makes Tamar stick out. And that's part of that boldness and the story of like, wow, she's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Interesting. So I can't help but think that Jesus probably would have known this story. You know, he's clearly, we know he spent a lot of time in the temple reading and studying, and he probably would have known this story and probably would have known, you know, Tamar was one of his ancestors. And I can't help but wonder if this knowledge or this, you know, knowing about those who have come before him, if that played into his ministry at all. What do you think?
I think, you know, yeah, Jesus, you know, knows scripture and he knows the stories. And so that's for sure. For me, I think one of my opinions on this is like when we read John chapter 8 about the story of the woman caught in adultery, and then they bring her out and say, Jesus, our laws say this is a woman caught in the act of adultery. The scripture says we should stone her. What should we do to trap him? Because if he says stone her, they'll be like, what a heartless, horrible person. And they'll smear him. If he says, don't stone her, then they'll say, oh my gosh, he doesn't follow the law. This was an utter trap. And Jesus responds and says, let the person with no sin cast the first stone. I'm like, wow, what a move. And then everyone walks away. There's a part of me that thinks that that scenario was set up knowing the mothers of the Messiah, the women who are in his lineage, what they went through, and how they acted, how they were forced to act by the society. And so I think that his justice and kindness and compassion toward it is not to say, oh, keep doing what you're doing, but to say, you know what, like, he understands. God will judge, but he, in that moment, takes judgment away from the people who thought they could judge. And he's like, stop that. And so that's, I think, a thing of beauty where understanding the stories of what his foremothers went through gave him compassion to understand how the system is so easily piles on against the marginalized and the weak and the silenced. And he masterfully handles that in chapter 8. And just to add to whole how we pick and choose and how awful it is, my response to John 8 is when they bring the woman out naked, you know, wrapped in a sheet or whatever it is, and say, like, look, we just caught her. My question is, like, dude, where's the guy? Where's the counterpart of this adulterous relationship? There was no man. And so I think Jesus just sees women's, you know, the way they're treated by society, and he understands. So that's one of the ones that stick out to me the most.
Yeah, yeah. So interestingly, Matthew is the only genealogy that mentions women. You know, there's the genealogy in Luke that is significantly different than the one in Matthew. And Matthew lists these four women that we're going to be doing for the next 4 weeks. Yeah. And Matthew was writing to a Jewish, traditionally Jewish audience. And so as just like Jesus, they would have known these stories of these four women as well. Mm-hmm. Why do you think Matthew may have included these women, including Tamar, in his lineage?
I'll be honest, like the story of Tamar is so amazing of what she went through. But we can't just focus on that. And it ends so quickly that it's almost like an afterthought. Tamar's story, as dramatic as it is, results in her having the sons through which brings us to David and then to Jesus. But even the story of her sons is reflective of why Tamar's story matters. Because for the Israelite people, as patrilineal as they are, as much as they uphold the firstborn son, Israel comes from the secondborn. Israel comes from Isaac, Abraham's promised child. But if we look at it, Isaac is not Abraham's firstborn. Ishmael is. Isaac is the secondborn. And so when we look at the social laws, everyone's going to be like, hey, man, it's Ishmael, is it not? But God kept saying, it's the promise. It's my promise, not the natural human law. It's my promise. And so Isaac is that. And then Jacob and Esau's story, famous twins, Jacob coming out, grabbing his older brother's heel to be the deceiver who ends up taking the birthright from Esau. And then it's through the second son, the story continues. And then with Judah, Tamar is pregnant with twins. So Zerah is the firstborn, sticks his hand out of his mom's womb. They tie a crimson thread to identify, oh, here's the first one. You have twins and this is the first one. But when he pulls his hand out, Perez pops out. And they're like, whoa, what is this? And Perez, the second one, without the crimson string, comes out, and it's to Perez that we go to David. Once again, Tamar's secondborn. And throughout Israel's history, it's this weird secondborn who shouldn't have the status, who should be the more marginalized one, that carries forth the story. And so with what Tamar goes through, with the story of her offspring, it captures Israel's story of the promise of God being the power through which we go forward over the social norms and the laws that humans create. And so I think that that is something there. With Tamar, I think that we have takeaways that are amazing. But when I look at Matthew writing to a Jewish audience, the story of Tamar and her offspring makes a lot of sense of why it was included. But because we're doing the study of Credo and looking at the four women, there it preaches. Did Matthew have that forward in mind? I don't know, but it makes sense that these women rose to the top because of what they went through, offspring-wise, and their own stories of resilience and what we learn from that and what it points toward Jesus' ministry. And so when Jesus came, his message wasn't obey the authorities. Let's keep it status quo. Might is right. That's not what Jesus did. Jesus came and turned it around and showed another way. And I think the stories of the four mothers show that other way that is such a theme in Jesus's ministry.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think it's so interesting that, you know, he didn't choose women like Sarah and Rachel, who are, you know, we think of kind of as the mothers of that, of the Jewish faith early on. Mm-hmm. You know, these women are obscure, smaller stories almost, which is just so interesting. If someone had never heard of Tamar before, folks at home, I do hope you're going to check this story out for yourself. But if someone had never heard of this story before, what is the one thing that you would want them to remember about this story?
Tamar's story is really just powerful because of the forces that she fights. We cannot look at this story without understanding the desperation that she must feel, with no recourse, utterly hopeless, defeated by looking at her circumstances and say there is no hope. And we multiply that by looking at the next three women, and you realize, oh my gosh, you're stuck. And so to see then in the desperation and in the knowledge of the culture, she's a Canaanite woman, but she kind of got understanding of how Israelite law works, and she leaned into that because she could have done Canaanite things and gone to where her world was familiar. But she, as an outsider, was brought into this Israelite world, and she adopted it, and she lived it, and she took that law, and she knew it, and then she applied it. And in applying it, it's so easy to judge. Ew, why? How could you do that? That's so horrible. And that's our initial approach at the judgment of what these women do. But if we look at what they're doing and the circumstances they are with the powers, where Judah, who has all the power, sends her away to be like, hey, I'm out of here. So what are you going to do? Do a smear campaign and come back and say, oh, my father-in-law didn't give me my husband. Then maybe she'll be a little noise, but like, they can ignore it. They're not going to be booed off of the main player stage of society. They can ignore it. It's a blip in their, you know, tabloid radar, but they'll be fine. But Tamar does this plan that, again, is questionable, is very much brings judgment. And she, as a matter of fact, breaks the law. And there's a part of it that's like, who made these laws to say that you can't do prostitution, you know, because, like, God made that law. That's not what my point. My point is that the recourse that she has is to use that which is outlawed to get the justice that she needs. And that's what's crazy. She lived in faith, she lived in conviction, and she moved forward. And I have to emphasize here, God didn't give her supernatural strength. She acted in faith and conviction, and she did it. And what happens is something wonderful. But I will also note that people who do terrorist moves, who act very violently, also are doing sometimes in faith and with full conviction. And we're like, what's going on? So I'm not saying, oh, we should learn from Tamar to break all the rules and then just do whatever we want to get the ends we need. But I think Tamar teaches us that she values relationship over rule. And we see that justified in the end. And that's where it's not, rules are important. It gives us order. But the value is the community. The value is the relationship. Rules are there to keep people safe and again, order. But sometimes rules blindly cover over injustice. And Tamar teaches us in her story a sense of moving forward in faith, doing what she has to do. And there's, again, it's bold and brave because there's nothing but judgment that she faces. But when she comes through it and we look at what happened, there is a deep sense of, oh my gosh, I understand. That makes sense. How hard it was. Even Judah said, I proliferated. I had all the power. I did the wrong move and I messed Tamar up, and she's more right than I. That is Tamar's story. It forces the people with the power to acknowledge I was wrong. These rules, what I did was wrong. And I think that Tamar, we need more Tamars. The world, especially in today, need more Tamars to see what are the rules that we're putting up that protect those with the power and silence and just put even more desperate those without any power or recourse. And so I think that that is what I would say. Tamar is an amazing story to inspire those who feel they're without hope. But I will say again, it's tough because rule breaking is just in general difficult. But we have a guide when we uphold the community and the good for the sake of. Yeah.
Thank you, Jonah, so much for this. It has just been so wonderful to really dive deep into this story of Tamar and to especially hear that last point and really get us thinking about what that might mean to value relationships so much and the righteousness that Tamar had shown. So thank you again so much. And thank you, folks at home. I hope you'll join me next time in the living room when I meet with Reverend Natalie Owens Pike to talk about Rahab, the next mother of the Messiah.
Thank you for listening to Crossroads. Our managing editor is Jamie Staley, and our editors are Vashina Brisbane and Emily Dombroff.